You're listening to the Shift Work Podcast, episode 93. Today's guest is known to the Harvard Business School as the sales therapist. So if you feel like you can up your sales game, today's episode is for you. She shares with us today her cognitive behavioral approach to sales. She gives an absolute masterclass into the sales process and how you can change your mind and the way you think about sales. And she shares with us today a three-question closing sequence that will help you to increase your sales and close more business. So stay tuned. Hi, I'm Luke Lehman. And you're listening to the only podcast for high-growth entrepreneurs rooted in business strategy and tactics as we discover the habits of high-performance leaders and dive deep into brain science. With over two decades leading high-performance teams, from fighter pilot to CEO, I'm excited to join you in your entrepreneurial journey. Shift the mindset needed to build your empire, keep more money in your pocket, and enjoy every day of the journey. Welcome to Shift Work. Hey, my friends, welcome back to the Shift Work Podcast. I am going to jump right into the interview today with Carol Mahoney because I am just so excited to share her with you. She is an absolute sales genius. She just published a book called Buyers First to help you grow your business with collaborative selling. I just love her approach. She's known to the Harvard Business School as the sales therapist. There's so much goodness in this episode. You're going to want to grab a pen and take notes. And make sure that you check out the show notes for all the resources and the ways to connect with Carol. So let's dive right in. Carol, I am personally so excited for this episode today because we're going to dive into sales. And as much as I might think I'm a good salesperson, I'm excited for you to share and teach me how to become a better salesperson today.
Yes, I'm excited for this as well.
So we're going to hop right in, Carol. We're celebrating together the release of your new book. And we're going to talk a lot about Buyer First as your book. But what I want to hop right in today is I want to take a look at the brain-based science behind sales. And I know a lot of what you've written in your book has to do with the way that we approach our sales behaviors. You talked a lot about your theory of planned behavior and action in the work that you do with Harvard Business School. And you shared with me in the pre-show a story about your grandmother. And I'd love just kind of, if you can share with the audience a little bit about your story and that work that you do around the cognitive behavior approach.
Yeah, I call this my sales origin story. And I think we all have one. And for most of us, it's not very good. I grew up in a family of entrepreneurs. My grandmother, who you mentioned, Grandma Mahoney, she owned one of the first woman-owned real estate brokerages in Massachusetts in the 70s. And so she was definitely at the forefront of this. My grandfather had a sporting goods store and it was a freelance, wrought iron welder. My mother owned a painting business. So I think entrepreneurship is just in my DNA. As I was growing up, you know, it was interesting. My grandmother was, she was the epitome of the salesperson in our family. She was always on. When I would spend my summers with her in Massachusetts, she would take us to all of the open houses, all of the networking meetings. Like by 9 years old, I could introduce myself effectively at a networking meeting. Like what other 9 year old can say that? But it was also a little bit of a struggle for me because she was always on, and she would go into a restaurant with us and she would see people that she knew or maybe had in passing, and she would go up to them and she would ask them the most uncomfortable questions. And it would be like, oh, honey, oh, how are you doing? Looks like you're pregnant. You're going to need some more room and not just in the waistline. How much is hubby making now? We've got this beautiful house on the harbor, plenty of room to park your cars. And she would just start diving into these sensitive questions with people. And meanwhile, I'm over like standing behind her and I'm just like, can I just disappear right now? This is so embarrassing. It's funny because even though I was embarrassed, she also was the kind of person who always seemed to get what she wanted exactly how she wanted it. She was my real first role model. But the other half of my sales origin story was the used car salesman that my mother had met and had moved in with us. And he was just horrible. He was a con artist. He was manipulative. He was a liar. He was all of these things. And in my mind, sales was this pushy, slimy, icky thing that you had to do. And when I grew up and went to college and graduated and had this idea of starting my own business and doing marketing for small business owners, in my mind, I wanted nothing to do with sales. I didn't want anything to do with the embarrassing moments of my grandmother or the icky, slimy things of my mother's boyfriend. And so I decided that I was going to do such awesome marketing that no one was going to need salespeople anymore, that the internet, you know, this was the age of SEO and pay-per-click, and that the internet was going to make salespeople obsolete. Long story shorter, what ended up happening is that I realized that we still need salespeople to help us make decisions, but I struggled with it because of the preconceived notions that I had about sales. And in Harvard Business School, when I started doing sales coaching with them, I thought it was just me. Like, you know, I just didn't know enough. I wasn't smart enough. But when I wanted to teach the Harvard students about how to have a sales conversation, they had a role play that they had to do based on a case study. And they went into these conversations. At first, it was just, you know, a normal, everyday human interactive conversation. But then the moment that they had to slip into the buyer and seller roles, it's like they became completely different people. Like they had put on costumes and masks. And the students were, you know, going into their pitch hard and fast, talking fast, never asking any questions, immediately offering discounts at the end, which, by the way, is not good sales behavior, just so we're clear. And when I gave them some pushback and said, you know, why is it that you didn't ask more questions? What they said was, well, isn't that what a salesperson's supposed to do? Give the pitch, ask for the business. And if I ask questions, aren't they going to think that I don't know what I'm talking about? And that's when I realized that whatever our sales origin stories are, mine growing up with entrepreneurs or these Harvard students who had a perception of what sales is, it's almost as if we're perpetuating this pushy, slimy sleaziness because that's what we think normal salespeople would do. And in psychology, they call that the theory of planned behavior or reasoned action. And what it says is that it's our attitudes towards a behavior that will influence how we do it, or even if we do it, or even if we're willing to learn to do it in a different way. And I had to then ask myself the question, are we just creating more of the same because of these psychological biases that we have towards sales? Like nobody wants to be pushy, slimy, and sleazy. But when your back is against the wall and you have to make payroll or pay your bills, you'll do whatever you have to do to make that happen, whether you want to or not. And that's when I realized that if we can apply the science and psychology of how we think about actions, maybe we can change the perceptions of sales. And that's when I started digging into it. And that's what you'll see a lot of the research in there. But it all started with my grandmother and a used car salesman back in the 70s.
Okay. Well, I'm excited for the listeners today because there's so many places to go. All right. So cognitive behavioral approach seems to me that it's leaning a bit against cognitive behavioral therapy, which we know is a traditional CBT therapy. Am I hearing that correctly?
Yes. Yeah. And you know, what I wrote in the book was actually exercises that people could go through to start to enact a cognitive behavioral approach to their own sales mindsets so that they can adapt the behaviors that buyers value and they can get different results because of it.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you in just a moment to share your five-step approach to that. So that's come in for all the listeners that go, okay, give me the tips and tricks and hacks. And I know the interesting thing is that most people come and they think that they want the tips and tricks and hacks, but we're really trying to move away to a more evolved approach. And I want to go to sales origin stories now, because what I'm curious about, I know that people behave out of a positive intent. And that even then when we make mistakes, that there's a positive intention behind it. So if I go back and I share with you, Carol, your passion for brain science, and I, you know, one of the big deep understandings that I've come to realize is the understanding of neural pathways and how they're really refined by age 8. And then by 22 or 28, they're done. And you can't really relearn a lot of those things without very heavy behavior changes. Mm-hmm. But my question is, where was it reinforced for us as children? That slimy sales tactic, which is what you've described as the Harvard Business School students reinforcing, there has to be a reason from brain science or from behavioral approach that says that we think this will work. And where does that come from?
It comes from a lot of different places. I mean, honestly, if you look at the origin of sales itself, and the methodologies that were in place, like back in, you know, Ford Motor Company, the very first sales methodology that they proposed was called the science of selling. And you know what it was? It was the measurement of someone's forehead to determine how smart they were to be able to take on new ideas. Literally, this was what they called the science of selling. And then it doesn't get much better because then we get into the barrier method, which you've probably experienced if you've ever had a life insurance salesman in your house that then said to you, well, if you passed away, you would want your family to be taken care of, right? With your family sitting right there. Of course, you're not going to say no to that. And so I think a lot of the origin of this perception of sales as pushy, slimy, and sleazy comes from the origin of sales itself, because they didn't know any better. And so that has become the norm in sales for the last 125 years or so. Like, if you think about it, like the Renaissance, the medical profession. Medical professionals were not seen as trustworthy scientific, you know, helpers. They were seen as religious fanatics and barbarians that, you know, applied leeches to people and things like that, because they blindly followed the teachings of a few. And it wasn't until they started introducing scientific process and dissection into it that they started to gain the level of respect that they have today. And I think that's what we are seeing in sales today. When we start introducing the brain science and the data and neuroscience behind how people actually make decisions and base our sales approaches on that, that's how we're going to start to be able to shift this perception of sales as being pushy, slimy, and sleazy, because it's always been, well, this is what so-and-so did, so I'm going to do what so-and-so did, and I don't understand why it doesn't work for me the same way. It's because we're basing it off of the limited teachings of a few. And so when we think about our sales origin story, you would say, you know, we form these synapses in our brains by the age of 8, but that doesn't mean that we can't start to change those, again, using data and science to be able to reduce some of the biases in there. And it does take some work, but I think that people are just so desperate for results that they will cling to anything. I remember thinking when I was first a business owner, if someone would just tell me the exact steps that I need to take, I will do those steps so that I can get to the results that I want. But then when those steps don't work exactly the same way, we give up and then we move on to the next fad. You know, it's like fad diets, right? Like, okay, I'm going to do the shake diet because it's working for everybody else. But then we kind of give up on it after a while and we move on to what the next fad is going to be.
So if we go a little deeper, one of the things that I love about cognitive behavioral therapy is that we don't necessarily need to go back and revisit or relearn from those things, but understanding how those neural pathways were connected so that we can reform the beliefs that we make around it. One of my questions, and at least my levels of curiosity around sales, and a lot of my reflections, Carol, come back from just being a parent. I realize that a lot of the way that I think and behave, and I look at it, well, you know, I'll give you an example from a sales process. If we're always persuading and influencing, if I were trying to get my son to not hit his sister, I might go in there with what would be a very simple sales process with the benefits and the outcomes and the reprimand, right? You know, and it's essentially a bind, right, is what I'm saying to them. But to be able to say, if you do this, then you will get this. And I put a very simple reward on it. And I know, Carol, I know that it's a very bad sales process. But my question is, if I think back to my own childhood, if my parents gave me the same sales tactics, now I didn't get my way as a child. That's for sure. And we can talk about power bases and referent power and some of those position power. But I just wonder if we've anchored, you know, is our neural pathways are set as children that goes, well, clearly that works. My parent engaged in that sales tactic and they got what they wanted. Can we take it back that far to childhood? Are we reaching too far?
You absolutely can take it back to childhood. So here's an example. My oldest son, when I would try those tactics with him, if you do this, then this is the reprimand or this is the reward. His response was, I don't care about either. Now what? And a lot of times that's how our buyers are acting, is that we try to present this risk versus reward to them, but sometimes they're so wrapped up in their own biases that it just doesn't matter to them. And they ghost us or they don't respond to us because we haven't actually dug into what's really going on with them or understood what's actually motivating for them. What's the impact for them? What's the risk in their minds for this? And so we go about it thinking like, okay, well, this would work for me, but it doesn't always necessarily work for the other person. And so, you know, with my son, I had to come up with some very unique questioning techniques to get an understanding of what's really going on. Like, what is it about? Like, use the example of your son hitting your other child. Mine did the same thing. And so I had to ask him some questions like, what caused it? What made you feel that this was the only choice that you had, and start digging into sort of the inner dynamics of that? I kind of look at it as we have to be able to meet people where they are, not where we want them to be.
So now you're speaking my love language when we talk about heuristics and biases, which I do know that when we kind of get into your framework here and we talk about it, it's really step 2 and step 4. We'll talk about the biases here in just a moment. But what I want to understand about your sales methodology is that, you know, you're wearing the shirt and you've got the Not About Me hashtag and it's upside down. Yeah. Tell me more about this Not About Me movement and how you apply it to your sales processes.
It actually all started when I was at, I would say, rock bottom when I started my business. I actually opened the book with the story of how I couldn't sleep at night because I wasn't able to even buy groceries or Christmas presents for my kids. And I was like, okay, maybe I'm just not cut out for this entrepreneurship thing. I started to look for a job and my sister introduced me to her boss, Jack. And Jack had, you know, was very candid with me. And he said, you know, it's really between you and one other candidate. And I don't know which one to choose. What would you do if you were me? Now, my first reaction was to obviously look out for my own best self-interest. I need this job. My husband's losing his mind. He can't buy a six pack of beers. Like, I need to get this job. But then also in the back of my mind, I thought, this is my sister's boss. And what happens if I take this job and I'm not the right fit and it doesn't work out? How is that going to reflect on her? How is that going to affect my relationship with her? But then, you know, here's Jack in front of me asking for my advice because he doesn't know what to do. How is that going to affect my relationship there? And so I swallowed what was I considered my own pride and what I wanted. And I asked him, I said, well, what's the most important aspect of this job for you? And when he told me and I realized that it wasn't something that was my strength, but I knew the other person he was considering and it was theirs, I said, you should hire the other person because while I would love to do that, it's just not my strong suit and I can probably find something that's a better fit. And in that moment, he said to me, thank you so much for making this decision easier for me. I'm going to reach out to some of my contacts to find out who might be able to use your services to help you to get some work. And that had never happened before. And I went home that night and I was talking to my husband about it. And he's like, well, what was different about this conversation than the others? I said, I wasn't trying to sell him on what I wanted. I was looking out for what was actually in his best interest. And he said, well, maybe you just need to stop selling people to get more clients. And that's when I realized when I stop making it about me and what I want, that's how I can start to break through the barriers of trust because I'm actually looking out for the best interests of the other person. It changed the way I showed up for calls. It changed the way I ask my questions. It changed my entire sales process. And not only that, it changed my relationships with my friends, with my family, with my kids. And that's when I was like, okay, there's something more behind this. And that's when I started digging into the brain science behind how we form trust in relationships and how we're actually able to motivate other people to make change. Not necessarily persuade, influence, and get them to do what you want, but how do you help them to make a change that's in their best interest?
Okay, so I want to go there because I want to talk about persuasion and influence. And I love persuasion and influence. It's almost like a four-letter word, although I think probably there's about 22 letters there, is that if you don't like being persuaded, or if you don't like being influenced, you create a barrier for yourself that says that I also would not want to impact others. And I think that's why there's a natural disposition to folks that who are good salespeople is because they realize there is a way to be in integrity. And some of them are not, of course, but to be in integrity, to persuade and influence. And I'd like to just go there for a minute. How do you reconcile for someone who might not be genetically predisposed to persuasion influence? How do you reconcile for them that you can attempt to persuade or influence another person and to do it in integrity without manipulation?
Well, the thing is none of us want to be sold to. Has anyone ever said, I was so completely sold on this and had a positive experience? Not very many people would say that. I'm sold is more like a resignation than it is a joyous occasion. And we don't want to be sold to. We don't want to be. I did a number of interviews with people who actually had to make buying decisions. And one of the overriding themes that I had during these interviews is that they didn't felt listened to. They didn't felt that the other person understood their situation. And they also felt like, you know, they were just another number in that person's mind. Like they were going through their checklist of questions. And I think we've all had that kind of experience before. Like if you've ever tried to buy a car recently, you've probably had that experience. But we do want someone who's going to help us to figure something else. We want help. And so when we think of selling of instead of something that I'm going to do this to you, selling isn't something we do to other people. It's something that we do with them. And when you actually look at how people make decisions and what they value in sales conversations today, people want to be collaborated with. There's a study that was done out of Harvard Business School, I think back in 2012, called the IKEA effect. And like the IKEA store, like, you know, you go there, you buy something and you put things together. But what they found was that people who had a say in putting something together for themselves actually placed more value on it and were willing to pay more for it than something that was put together for them by an expert, because they felt like they had been listened to, that they had been collaborated with, and that the thing that was created for them was special and unique to them in their situation. And so selling, if you even look up the definition of selling, it's an exchange of value. An exchange. It's not one person doing something to the other. It's an equal and collaborative nature. But somehow in our heads, because of all of the methodologies that have come up in sales, we think it's something that we have to do. We focus on the tactics. We don't focus on the mindsets behind the tactics. You mentioned, like, most of us have a positive intention to do something. Yes, but for the most part, it doesn't always come off that way, because we come off as, I need to have the answer to this question in order for me to pitch you. Like when we're asking someone what their budget is for a particular project, in their buyer's mind, they're immediately thinking, if I tell them my budget, they're going to use my entire budget. And so they might give a different number or say, I don't know yet, because they don't trust you enough with that kind of information. And so when we think of that collaboration, that's what happens in a sales process where you start to build trust. And in fact, there was a study that was another study that was done at Harvard University that showed when elaboration questions or clarification questions get asked, it actually releases an area in our brain where we get dopamine. And that releases pleasure in our brains, which means we love answering questions that ask about our opinions, what we think of something. You know, like right now, you're asking me all these questions. My brain is lighting up with dopamine right now. It's also the same part of our brains where we form relationships and attachments. And so by asking collaborative questions that ask people what their thoughts and opinions are on things to form a solution together, that's how we can actually change sales from this, I'm going to persuade you to do the thing that I think you should do because this is what I sell, and then into a more collaborative situation where, you know what, this might actually not be the best fit for you, given what you've shared with me about your situation and your goals and the challenges that you have and the impact that we know that would have. Instead, you probably want to go and look at this. And so a true sales conversation is about finding the best fit for them, even if that isn't the solution you offer.
Wow. Mindset behind tactics, you said. How do I develop a mindset that is supportive of the process? And I like the collaborative approach. How do I do that?
So the first step that I have my coaching clients go through, whenever you want to go through any type of a behavioral change, is to set what is your personally meaningful goal. And this isn't just something that's based on an outcome. You know, one of the examples that I use in the book was how I lost 105 pounds during the pandemic. Now, I had struggled with weight most of my life. I could blame it on genetics. I could blame it on health. I don't have a thyroid, so I don't have a metabolism. There are all kinds of good reasons why I wasn't able to lose the weight. And it wasn't until I started applying the approach that I use for my sales clients to myself and identifying what is my personally meaningful goal and what are the mindsets and beliefs that are getting in my way of doing what I know I can and should do. I know I should exercise. I know I should eat more vegetables. We know we should be actively listening and asking really good questions and putting others first. But somehow when we get in the situation and we're hungry and we've got a pepperoni pizza in front of us, our, you know, most common base denominator gives into that and we just go with it because that's what we're comfortable with. The mindsets and beliefs and sales that I talk about are very specific. And it first starts with those goals to understand, why would you want to go through this work of changing a behavior? Because it's not something that happens overnight and it's not something that's easy, but it is something we can do because we change our minds all the time. So first it's the goals, but then I have them take an objective assessment of their actual strengths and their actual skills and the mindsets and beliefs that are feeding those, either helping them or hindering them. And I use a third-party data-based assessment. It's like over 2.3 million salespeople over 30 years have taken it. So it's predictive as far as analytics go. But what that does is it helps to reduce our own biases. The Dunning-Kruger effect is something that I do this for, because the less experience that we have in something, the more confident we are in our abilities to do something. Psychologists call it Mount Stupid because there's this peak of experience and confidence that kind of goes there. And then the more experience we get, our confidence starts to wane because we realize, I don't know what I don't know. Unfortunately, that's a long, hard, and expensive process to go through in your business and sales. So by doing an objective assessment, it creates a level of self-awareness that they can say, oh, that's what is always happening to me in these situations and why. And what it really does is dig into the specific beliefs that are feeding the mindset. one of the most common ones that I encounter with business owners and salespeople and leaders is a need for approval. We all have a need for approval. We were, you know, as babies, when children, when we were, you know, doing something new, the first thing that we did is we looked to our parents for approval to see if we were doing it right. That's hardwired into our brains. However, when we get into a sales situation, we have the belief of, for example, a very common one is people need to like me in order to buy from me. If people don't like me, then they're not going to buy from me. And so I can't upset them. I can't do anything that's going to cause them not to like me. For example, asking a tough question. Or maybe challenging them on the way that they're thinking about something. And when we don't do that and we say yes to everything, oh, yes, I can do that. Yes, I totally understand that. Yes, 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 yes. We don't trust the yes person. We trust the person who will tell us maybe the things that are hard to hear, but we need to hear. You know, that friend that tells you the truth of things, that's the person that we go to when things are down and out. And so that one belief creates and feeds this need for approval mindset. Or like with my Harvard students, they said, aren't they going to think I don't know what I'm talking about if I ask too many questions? That belief of how I'm going to appear to someone, that need for approval, is what prevented them from asking questions that they were taught in class to ask. So it wasn't like they didn't know what to do and didn't know how to do it. It's that in the moment, they were worried what the other person was going to think, and so they didn't do it. And that's how, you know, and there's five different beliefs or mindsets that I focus on when I'm working in, with sales and business owners. But the need for approval is probably one of the biggest ones. Another one is the emotional involvement in a sale. You know, we get excited when we hear the buying signals. This is really great. I can't wait to show this to my team. You know, this totally aligns with our budget. I think this is going to solve our problem. And we get so excited about what they're saying, we're wrapped up in it, or we hear objections like, I think this is too expensive. And so we get wrapped up in our heads and we become these time travelers where we're thinking about past failures, or we're hearing buying signals. I had one salesperson tell me I was already calculating my commissions after I had heard these buying signals, and you've checked out. You're not actively listening anymore. You're not picking up on the body language or the tone of voice or the pauses that someone has to then be able to dig in and ask a tough question. I remember one sales conversation I had that I had asked a tough question and the person on the other end paused for a really long time. And I said, so either you're not comfortable answering that question, or this is like your wife asking you to take the trash out after dinner and you just don't want to answer. And he laughed and he's like, well, that's very perceptive. But it was being comfortable with the pause and asking the question that enabled me to do that. And so when we're not present, we're not actively listening. And because we're so worried about how this is going to affect us, what's in it for me? How is this going to impact me? That belief causes us to get emotionally involved and check out. So there's a number. I mean, there's probably hundreds of different beliefs that we measure for that feed into these different mindsets. And so it's first identifying through a cognitive behavioral approach, where is this coming from? What does it mean for me? I also ask people, you know, what's the double standard? If someone asked you a tough question, would you think that they're a horrible person? So then why would you apply that standard to yourself? And then, you know, and I also try a couple of other, you know, CBT techniques, such as, you know, in 5 years from now, how are you going to feel about this particular thing? Or what's the worst case scenario here? And is it really all that bad? And kind of applying some logic to it. A lot of times I have business development reps who have to make cold calls every day. And, you know, getting hung up on or calling, you know, being called bad names isn't very much fun. And so for them, I often have to go back into, all right, where does your validation really come from, though? Is it the stranger on the phone? Your dog's still going to love you tomorrow. Your family's still going to love you tomorrow. How much does this really matter in the scheme of things? And so by applying these cognitive behavioral approaches and understanding what's going on underneath the tactic or lack of, that helps them to then adopt the tactic and feel comfortable in the moment saying it. I have countless clients who have come to me and said, I never would have asked that question, but there was a little Carol on my shoulder whispering in my ear, telling me that it was going to be okay. And then they went ahead and did it. And so finding those quick wins for them as well is another way that people can start to change their mindsets and beliefs. Sometimes we're so focused on the outcome, we forget about the little wins along the way that tell us that we're going in the right direction. And so by celebrating those small, quick wins is another way that I've found that people can start to change their beliefs towards a behavior and an action to get a different result.
Carol, I wish that people knew what you just said there and they could really diagnose so many of the components that you just articulated that were truly masterful.
Thank you.
And from a sales component, you did a few things there. the use of analogies, you know, as a trick. Mm-hmm. Future pacing is one that we know that we could say as a tactic of the sales process. But mm-hmm. I want to go back for just a moment. I want to go back to the first. You said the need for approval. And it's something that I talk about a lot on this show. So fear-based responses drive and dictate many of our decisions. And I know that two of the greatest human fears, and this is something that when I articulate this, that people are surprised by, that it's not public speaking, that it's not death, that two of our greatest fears are simply inadequacy and judgment. And it usually falls one or on the other, and it's usually internal or an external. But that need for approval is just the counter argument, the alternative to that, to say, I don't want to feel inadequate, or I don't want to feel rejected. And it's a human behavior. You can't get over it. You have to acknowledge, I don't want it. I don't want to get to the end of this show. And Carol says, man, you're a terrible podcast host and I reject you. But I do acknowledge that sometimes I'm going to get myself into positions that by exposing myself that I may get out a little bit over my skis. So how then do we, Carol, get over that? What do you use to coach, teach, mentor others to help them get over that inadequacy and judgment fear, or that fear of rejection, and get them into an approval state, or that need, satiate or satisfy that need for approval?
So one of the most common things that I do with them is get them to align. You're right. We all need approval. We all need validation. It's when we start seeking it in the wrong places that it gets us into trouble. And so one of the first things that I, in the goal setting exercise, for example, that I have my clients go through, part of that exercise is describing a day in the life of their perfect day. You know, how does your morning start? Who's with you? What are the sights, the smells, the noises that are around you? And who else is with you? And the who else is with you part, those are the people that you should be seeking your approval from, not the random buyer on the other end of the phone. So seek your approval in the places where it's appropriate so that you feel fulfilled as a human being and you're not seeking your approval from the random strangers that you're talking to. And I also ask them to think about it this way, is if you were walking down the street and there was someone on the street who you had seen had fallen down, they had too many packages in their hand. Are you the kind of person that's going to walk by because they didn't ask for your help? Or are you the kind of person that's going to put aside the fear of them telling you no and sit down and actually help them pick up their stuff anyway? Which person do you want to be? And so that helps them also to have kind of a framework in their mind to I'm not seeking approval for them. If I do that, then I can't actually help them because my own ego is getting in the way of it.
This is so meta, Carol. I wish people, again, it's just a masterclass. What that is called for the audience is called an identity bind. And it's a great sales technique. You know, which type of person are you? But mm-hmm. even, you know, it's interesting. And, you know, from a meta-analysis standpoint, and this is so hard to even really dissect and to get into, is that you're selling someone on the same sales techniques that they need to learn. And that future pacing that we just talked about, one of the most beautiful sales techniques, if you want to elicit a value, is to simply ask them to articulate how success is. It's the thing that I have used for so long is I don't need to say what's your budget. I don't need to ask that question. And I don't need to do discounts. Like you said, if I simply say, I just want you to imagine, Carol, that you and I are standing here at the end of this project and we turn around and we look backwards, what would you say are the most successful components of our time together? Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because you just wrote the book on a buyer first mentality that talks about a collaborative approach, but it's you and I standing together side by side. And when you do that, when you future pace someone, I know it's a tactic, it's a trick, it's a tip for our listeners that need the tactics and the trips, but why does it work? Is when I stand shoulder to shoulder with you, I show you that I'm not forward or aft of you, but I'm there with you. And the interesting thing for that, and I laugh at used car salesmen that you start this, they will tell you what their highest value is. They will tell you all the things that are most important to them in the buying process, and you don't need to use it against them. Mm-hmm. You need to help facilitate them with. So that's all my opinions, Carol, but I'd be super interested to hear in your studies and in your research for this book, what did you find about that collaborative approach?
So one of the things that I found, so there were several studies that were done where people interviewed buyers and asked, what is the thing that you value in a salesperson? There's a study from LinkedIn. A colleague of mine, Deb Calvert, surveyed over 500 B2B buyers. There's another, you know, countless other neuroscience types of studies. And what they found is that buyers said the thing that they value the most is someone who's going to help me think differently about my problem and solution. Tell me something I don't already know. If you're going in with your standard types of questions, you're not going to necessarily get there. And so it's that collaboration with them. But that collaboration needs to work towards what their desired future state is. And then understanding what is the gap between where they are and where they want to be, how do we fill the gap that's there? With the collaborative approach, again, people like answering questions that are going to ask them their thoughts and their opinions on something. The IKEA effect states that we place more value on something that we've had a say in creating than something that's been created for us. And then all of the studies from all of the buyers that have said, not someone who's going to help us to think differently about our problem, because it's not a lack of information. It's a lack of understanding and context that they're struggling with. What really matters? What do I really need to know about this? And so that's kind of how the collaboration needs to start. Even in the close itself is a collaboration. I teach a three-question closing sequence that is simply, do I understand everything about your world and what's going on right now? And if the answer is anything other than a yes, absolutely, then you need to ask some more clarification questions to get to that understanding. Because if the buyer doesn't think you understand them, they're not going to do anything with you. The second question is, do you believe that we have the expertise to help you with what you've described? Again, anything that an absolute yes, you need to dig into. And then the final question is, how would you like us to help? Or do you want our help? These are all questions that are asking for their input in the closing process so that you can create collaboratively with them when this needs to happen by. I teach layered questions as part of the process. And, you know, the first layer is like peeling an onion. If you have kids and you've ever watched the movie Shrek, when Shrek talks to Donkey, and he's like, it's like an onion. He's like, no, what about a parfait? Either way, it's layers. And the idea being is that you're at each layer, collaborating with them, building that trust and that collaboration and digging even deeper into what those issues are until you get to the point where your buyer says to you, I hadn't thought of it that way before. That's my goal with every sales conversation. And when I'm coaching clients, the goal that I have for them. Because when you get to that point with your buyer, that's when you know you've earned their trust and the credibility with them that they will listen to your advice now. Nobody wants to be sold to or at. And that's the thing that buyers complained about the most. I felt they were talking at me. I thought they were talking to me, but they didn't really understand me or my situation.
I'm just sitting here. It's funny, Carol, because I believe that I'm a good salesperson and I've got two pages of notes. And if I'm listening to this podcast right now, I'm flagging it, marking it for later. And I'm going to go, I got to come back and I got to listen to this. And I got to go back and I got to understand all of those things that Carol was doing, selling, talking meta about what we're talking about today. And I'm floored today as I've kind of gone through these things with you. Three question closing sequence. It's masterful. And I think that, you know, if I'm a young salesperson listening to this podcast, well, first of all, I'm going to go back. I'm going to listen to what they just were because I just took the notes as well. But what ends up happening is that we get to these micro commitments. We get to yes, yes, yes. They said yes three times. And I think when someone is ready to be closed, the interesting thing is that they'll ask, they'll say, okay, let's talk about price. And I don't ever talk about price, but when we've gotten to the price discussion, well, that's not true. I talk about price at the invitation of the client. When they say that they, like you have asked, do I understand you? Do you believe that we have the technical solution? Would you like our help? If they've said yes to all three of those, if it's natural and collaborative, the next question should be, okay, let's talk about money. And then, yeah, now we've got to actually get to some of the technical specifications of whether or not we are a good product market fit. I understand that. But those are just masterful in the sales process. And I am taken away by the level of understanding. And I think just the encouragement is for folks to go, I'm not a salesperson, to then you don't have to be a salesperson.
Yeah,
you have to be a friend and you have to be collaborative approach for that. And I just, you know, as you kind of do these assessments, what do you see and how do you help folks move from, I'm not here to persuade or influence or manipulate, but I'm here to be by your side and to help you through this process?
One of the first things that I tell people is we are all salespeople, right? Like whether you're the four-year-old convincing your kid to give you candy in the store or the parent trying to convince them to eat their vegetables and go to bed, the employee who has an idea and is asking for resources, to the business owner who has to sell or the salesperson, we are all in sales every day. Like if you're married, that was probably the best sale that you ever made. And so what that means is we've all been selling our entire lives. This is nothing new. It's just when money gets involved, that exchange of value, suddenly the dynamic changes for us because we have so many issues around money. And that's another one of the mindsets and beliefs that we talk about. You know, how much money is a lot? What do you have, an abundance mindset or a scarcity mindset? Because that's going to influence your ability to talk about money openly and creatively with your buyers. I actually encourage sellers to talk about money before you get to the close. Like that's one of the qualifiers is a lot of people want solutions. Not everyone has the ability to get those solutions or willing to pay for those solutions. That's another conversation about risk. But money is really just the means to get something or to get somewhere. And that's the other reason why I have my sellers go through what their personally meaningful goals are. Because if you don't understand that for yourself, it's going to be a lot more difficult for you to help someone else to realize that for themselves in the sales process. And so the ability to change these mindsets, to take the small steps, sometimes it's just a matter of understanding what's the belief that's getting in my way of doing the thing that I know that I need to do in the moment that I need to do it. And there are activities that you can do every single day in your everyday habits that are going to help you to change these things in small steps. So for example, if you find that you have a high need for emotional involvement in the sale, you get so excited or you get so flustered when an objection comes up. One of the things or some of the things that I encourage people to do is daily meditation, yoga, walks. You know, the basics of self-care is what's going to help you to manage your emotions in the moments that matter. For example, I talk about meditation in the book probably 11 or 12 times, and that's because it works. It actually will rewire your brain and help you to make better decisions when you can do 10 to 15 minutes of meditation every day, because it actually will change the breath work, changes the synopsis, the visualization, makes new connections in your brain. And so if you have an intentional effort in meditation, you can manage your emotions in those sales conversations. So it's not just about what's the latest tip or trick or hack, but what's the small behavioral change that I can make every day that's going to influence the beliefs and mindsets so that I can execute well in the tactics? And I think that's the thing that we go into sales training and we think, I need to just do these things. I need to buckle down and do it. But it really is more of a holistic approach to how you're taking care of yourself as a whole to see how you're going to show up for other people.
I love that, Carol. There's just so much grace and so much empathy in the way that you've articulated that. Now, I know, and I'm going to go buy it. And I know that if I'm sitting here on the receiving end of this, that I should be going to buy a buyer first to listen to what Carol Mahoney has said about how you grow your business with collaborative selling. So go buy the book, go support Carol. It's a great new book. And I'm excited to be on this journey with you, Carol. But if someone wants to learn more about you, where can they go to find out more about you?
So you can definitely go to my website, which is carolmahoney.com. Don't forget the E at the end of Carol or in Mahoney. You'll be able to get the book there. It's also the site where you can find out a lot about me and the speaking. I have my corporate training website, which is unboundgrowth.com. And then if you're looking for me on social media, you'll find me on LinkedIn. If you can't find me on LinkedIn, then I'm definitely doing something wrong. But that's where I spend most of my social time.
Carol, thank you. We'll link all those things up in the show notes so that folks have the resources. I personally am grateful for your time today. It's been an exciting show, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. If you found value in today's episode, please take the time to leave a review so that we can build our community of high growth entrepreneurs. If you'd like to stay connected with me, go to www.lukelehman.com to find a link to your social media channel of choice.